Good evening and welcome to CSIS. The book is The House at Sugar Beach. It's by Helene Cooper, who sits here with me. Helene wrote this book, and she's also the New York Times correspondent at the White House now.
Yes.
Has been in the past the State Department correspondent. I urge all of you to buy multiple copies.
They're being sold.
They're being sold in the back. This book is fantastic, and I hope all of you who haven't read it will take the opportunity to read it. It's Helene's search for her lost African childhood, and it's a book that I realized after I read it that she absolutely had to write. It was required. You had to do this. Right?
See, you're taking away all my talking points. You're supposed to say, why did you write the book? And then I'll say, well, actually, you know, the issue was, why did it take me so long to write the book?
Why did it take you so long?
I haven't really answered that question satisfactorily for myself. It's this story that I sort of had inside me for 23 years. And I think for many of those years, I was hiding. I didn't want to deal with Liberia. I didn't want to deal with a lot of what had happened when my family had left. A few years ago, I think it was around somewhere in 2000, some friends of mine and I went to Oxford, Maryland, to this crab shack over the Bay Bridge, and it was a beautiful, beautiful evening. We had cut out our work early, and we're sitting on the water drinking cold beer and eating crab. And I said something about how my ancestors were actually originally some of them were from the eastern shore of Maryland. Mm. And my friends are all reporters, and they're looking at me like, you're from Liberia. What do you mean your ancestors are from the eastern shore of Maryland? And I said, well, actually, I started to tell them about, you know, my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, Elijah Johnson, who was on the first ship that sailed of freed slaves and freed American blacks, who sailed to Liberia in 1820. And I told them about how my father's side, there were four Cooper brothers who sailed from Norfolk to Liberia in 1826. I told them about how these freed blacks founded Liberia, the first independent African country. And I told them a little bit about how, you know, the irony was that these freed blacks set up the same kind of antebellum society that they had fled from in the United States. I told them about how they established themselves as the elite in Liberia, and they built this country, but at the same time, you had so many members of the Liberian population, most of the what they call the native Liberians, who were not taking part in this wealth at all. I was born in 1966 into this so-called elite, basically with a silver spoon in my mouth, and I told them about how all of this sort of came to a head in 1980, when a group of soldiers staged a military coup overthrowing the so-called Congo regime, about how my uncle was executed on the beach by a firing squad, my family was attacked, and we ran away.
You saw this execution on TV.
I did, that night. So I'm sitting in Oxford, Maryland, telling my friends this whole sort of Cliff Notes version, and they're looking at me, and they kept saying, why haven't you written this? You're a reporter. Why haven't you written this? And I said, it's complicated, which is a really kind of lame answer. But at the time, I knew that I could never really write this book or write this story until I first reconciled myself with my separation from my sister, my adopted sister who we had left behind, Eunice, when my family ran away in 1980. And so The House of Sugar Beach couldn't be written until I first went back and found her.
And Eunice was the adopted sister who, when you moved into Sugar Beach, the house that your father built, after years of living in Monrovia, in the urban areas, you moved out to the sort of the country, the suburbs, but your family was the pioneer of the suburbs.
We were urban pioneers. We thought that, you know, development would follow us. I hated moving out to Sugar Beach. I was 7 years old, and it was the back of beyond as far as I was concerned. It was 11 miles outside of Monrovia. We were way in the bush. We had electricity, but we didn't have a telephone, which you can imagine at seven. It's like, you know, my dad would just look and said, who do you think you're going to call? And it's like, I want to call my friends. But we didn't have, and I just felt, we felt really, you know, I felt isolated I was, by the time I turned 8, you know, I was terrified to sleep alone in my room at night. I was convinced that Hartman and Niji and witch doctors and all the superstitious stuff that we all grew up with in Liberia, and I was convinced they were all going to come into my bedroom at night and get me. And so after, you know, months of me climbing into my parents' room, you know, at night and refusing to sleep by myself, my parents did what a lot of people in Liberia did. And they went out and they put out the word that their now 8-year-old daughter needed a live-in playmate. And Eunice's mother, a Bassa woman, brought Eunice to live with us. This was one of those things that often happened in Liberia where the native Liberians would bring their kids to live with the so-called Congo people because they knew their kids would get 3 square meals a day and a chance at education. And this was, again, part of this sort of class structure. So Eunice and I, from that moment, were raised as sisters, although the entire time we were raised together, we both knew we were different.
But you also were incredibly close, and unlike some other families, Congo families in Liberia, your parents really regarded Eunice as another daughter, and she was really a sister to you and Marlene, so much so that in a 22-bedroom house, all three of you most of the time slept in the same room.
Well, that's because we're all terrified of the Hartman and Niji and voodoo people. yeah, we did. We all slept in the same room, and it's because we were like, you know, Eunice had her own room. I had my own room. Marlene had her own room. Marlene is right over there. And we would drag our mattresses down the hallway every night into Eunice and I into Marlene's room because we figured if we were together, nobody would get us. You have to remember, let me back up a second because you guys are going to think I'm psycho. Our house got burgled every other day. Rogues, we call them rogues in Liberia, and that's burglars, and they would come in the middle of the night when you're asleep, and they'd break into the house, and they would take off, you know, this is so un-PC, but my mom was collecting ivory, and they would cart off her ivory, and then, you know, 2 days later, the Mdingo men who sold her the ivory would come back with more ivory, she would buy it from them, put it back up, and 2 days later, the rogues would come back and take it away, and it's like, I was convinced that the Mdingo men who sold her the ivory were in cahoots with
the rogues.
You
were the one that figured out the plot.
Hello, yes!
Right.
But anyway, so there was a little bit of method to our madness of being convinced. But a lot of this also was we would be in the room at night and just telling scary stories. And Eunice would terrify us with stories about the underwater spirits, the Niji who come into the lagoon when you're swimming at Sugar Beach and suck you under and take you off to God knows where. And we sort of grew up with, this was part of the whole African childhood where we grew up with these stories. And I look back at it now with this incredible fondness. But at the time, I was terrified.
It was very real to you.
It was very real to me.
Well, you know, the book is your search for your lost African childhood, but it really traces the history of your family going back to the 1800s, which you've mentioned before. You know, which also parallels the history of Liberia. The whole book is intertwined with the history of Liberia and the history of your family. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. My 4 greats, great-great-great-great-grandfather was Elijah Johnson. He got on that boat in 1820, the Elizabeth. He had been a soldier. He had fought in the War of 1812. He was a freed black. He'd been born free. And I haven't traced his parentage, but he was never a slave. But anyway, he was on the first ship. This was during the Back to Africa movement in the early 1800s, where the rationale here was that you couldn't have freed blacks living in the U.S. at the same time that you had enslaved blacks because they were setting the wrong example. You don't want all the black people thinking that you could be free. So the best way to solve that issue was to get rid of the freed blacks and send them back to Africa. And my great-great-great-great-grandfather volunteered to get on the ship. There were 88 of them, and they docked at Sierra Leone. They were there for 2 years. They sailed around the West African coast looking for land, and they finally ended up in Liberia. And so as they were building their houses and their settlements, they were attacked by the native Africans. There was a lot of fighting. Elijah Johnson was a soldier. He trained the men. He stood up for I was raised to be enormously proud of him. But at the same time, these settlers came to Liberia thinking that's because some of them could read and write, that they were civilized, and that they looked at the native Africans at the time as not civilized. And there was this class structure that was set up from the get-go to their, you know, I don't want to paint them as complete. I don't want to paint this as completely black and white, because at the time, a lot of the Native Africans were still engaged in the slave trade. And the settlers, the first thing they did was to abolish the slave trade in Liberia, and that was sort of the economic livelihood. And a lot of the tension came from that, but so because they got rid of this economic mainstay, but they couldn't stand to see people being sold into slavery at the same time that these Native Africans, a lot of them, were still selling their brothers and sisters. But from the start, there was sort of this tension between these two groups. And Liberia sort of developed from there. So it was sort of for a long time, as I grew up, you know, we looked at ourselves as, it's so ironic now looking back at it, we looked at ourselves as, I would look at other African countries and think, oh, look at the coup in Ghana and the coup this place, and, you know, we're not like that. We're, you know, we thought we were the sort of the ideal in Africa, and this is where, you know, everybody, but in reality, you know, the biggest difference between Liberia and the other African countries is that Liberia was colonized by black people, whereas the other African countries were colonized by white people. But you had the same type of, you know, the blacks that colonized Liberia in many ways acted like the Europeans did.
And your ancestor, Elijah Johnson, was the George Washington of Liberia. He was one of the real founders. And on the other side of the family, your relative, the Dennis family, was also one of the pioneers.
Yeah, the Dennis family and the Johnson family on my mother's side, and then on my father's side, the Cooper family, where there were four Cooper brothers who got on a ship in 1826, the Harriet, that sailed from Norfolk. And they went to Liberia, and they were businessmen. They set up, you know, and they went into, you know, sort of commercial, whereas the other side of my family was more into government. But so from both my mom and my dad's side is sort of it's all there.
And as things got bad in Liberia, you were there for when it got really bad, and you fled in 1980 with your mother and Marlene, and you didn't return until 23 years later, as we talked about, when you'd already made a life for yourself as a reporter in the United States, as a college graduate. You lived in several cities. Why did you go back? What made you go back after all those years when you had seen such terrible things happen to mm-hmm. your family and to your home and to your country?
We came here, and I was 14 years old. And, you know, I was in the 10th grade, and I went to school, American High School. It was pretty horrible. The first year or so, I didn't make friends.
This is in Knoxville.
Yeah, Knoxville, Tennessee, and then we moved to Greensboro to live with my dad. My parents had divorced by then. My mother went back to Liberia, and then, you know, the Liberia sort of descended during the 1980s and then the early 1990s into this ninth circle of hell, where you had Doe was killed, the guy who had instigated the coup, Charles Taylor invaded, and the country descended into civil war. And my mother came back here. And sort of the way I dealt with it was to cut it off. I got to thinking that Liberia wasn't a place where you lived. It was a place where you died. My dad had gone back home in 1985. In 1984, he died 9 months after he got back to Liberia. My uncle died. I saw all the killing. And you sort of see on the images coming out of the TV of Liberia was just my way, you know, it's very much I ran away from it. And I became much more American. I perfected my American accent. I got a job after college with first the Providence Journal as a newspaper reporter, then the Wall Street Journal. And I traveled all over the world writing about, you know, everything from Cambodia to Haiti to, you know, everything except Liberia. I felt like if I, you know, I couldn't deal with Liberia, so if I just, in my head, killed off everybody who was still in Liberia who I loved, then it wouldn't hurt me when they got killed, which is not a very healthy way to deal with it. And it all sort of came crashing down on me in 2003 in Iraq. I was in Iraq for the invasion embedded with the 3rd Infantry Division. And I felt
this
at
is the
time,
front line. The third yes, ID was yes, the first yeah, yeah. in.
And during the, you know, I during the war, I really felt physically like I was in the wrong place, and this was the wrong war. And on one night in Iraq, my Humvee got run over by a tank, and I was pinned to the wheel. There, you know, the soldiers are there screaming, and I still remember I couldn't move, and they're screaming, "Medevac, medevac! She's bleeding out, she's bleeding out!" And I really did think that this was it. I was dying. They finally pulled me out of the Humvee, and I'm standing. They spread me on the sand, and I'm lying on my back. And all I could think of is, if I'm going to die in a war, I should die in a war in my own country. And that was pretty much it for me. I was in Iraq when, at the very same time, Liberia was seizing up again in another horrible civil war. I didn't know where my sister Eunice, I hadn't talked to her in 15 years, didn't know if she was dead or alive. All this stuff was happening in my own country, and I was in Iraq. And it was just, I think it all just sort of boiled over.
You lost touch with Eunice because not only was Liberia under the power of dictators like Samuel Doe and then subsequently Charles Taylor, but the country was virtually destroyed. There was no electricity.
There's no
running water.
Yeah, you couldn't call. There were no telephones. You couldn't, in order to write somebody. Eunice and I wrote a lot when we first moved here. But as the mail system got destroyed, it got to the point where in order to contact or reach somebody in Liberia, you had to find somebody who was physically going there and give them a letter. And it just got, it sounds so lame, but it just got too hard. I couldn't, it was so hard to find her and so hard to keep in touch. But that's not really much of an excuse. And I think all of that, this whole feeling of abandonment, that I had abandoned my sister. And here I am gallivanting around the world as this reporter, and God knows what has happened to her sort of came down on me as well.
Before we talk about a little bit about what you found when you did go back, Helene, you tapped into some really painful memories to write this book, and I think it took a lot of courage on your part to do that. What were the hardest things that you had to revisit, and including, of course, leaving Eunice?
I'm not a really introspective person. One of the ways that I've always dealt with things is to just shut it down and keep going. Something bad happens, and you just shut it down and you move on. And that was the way sort of I dealt with the coup, the way I dealt with my family members being executed on the beach. My mother was gang raped. At the time by soldiers who were trying to get to us. She basically traded herself for her daughters. And in so many things that have happened in life, the way I dealt with it was just to you keep going, you paper over it, and you pretend, you don't pretend it doesn't happen, but you don't focus on it. So when I finally sat down to focus on it, that was probably my biggest challenge, because I found, this book took me 4 years to write. And the first couple of years, I was still trying to paper over everything. I was trying to write it just the facts, man. I wrote it, I wrote the first draft the way I, as a journalist, just this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened, and it was almost I was cheating. I felt like it was almost as if I was trying to see if I could get away without digging, and that was probably one of the hardest things, is going back and realizing that it doesn't mean anything if I don't dig and go back, and it sort of feels like a scab that you keep, it heals over and you go back and you dig and know how did you actually feel and why did you do this and why did you behave this way and why did you not go back before this to look for your sister? Why did you let her go? Why did you, and that I think was probably the hardest thing for me, because that doesn't come naturally to me.
Tell us about when you actually left Liberia and you had to leave Eunice behind. You and your mother and Marlene went to Roberts Field Airport and got on a plane. There were direct flights from Monrovia to
Pan Am.
Pan Am flights. Tell us what happened.
My mom had just been raped and brutalized. My uncle had been executed. My father had been shot. And we were pretty traumatized. And this all happened within a 1 week period of the coup. 2 weeks later, we left. My mom and my dad was still in the hospital. Decided that they were going to get the kids out and that my dad would come when his wound had healed. My mom asked Eunice to come with us, and she said no. She still kept in touch with her mom. She was never formally adopted by us. She just lived with us, and she was about to graduate from high school, and she didn't want to leave her mother just then. And I think we all thought oh, she'll come after she graduates in December. It'll only be a few months. You know, you're going off into the unknown, and you don't. You know, in my mind, I thought she would be following us
to go to college in America, like
yeah,
you all were going.
Yeah, but we got here, and we were basically, you know, African refugees. We didn't have any money, and it's like things sort of get away from you. And then my mother went back home, and then the whole idea of Eunice coming just sort of dissipated. That night at Robertsfield, when we left, I remember me and Marlene and my mom got on the plane. Pan Am. I still remember, it's really funny, whenever I walk onto a plane now, I can smell this, is this antiseptic sort of air freshener smell that Liberia smells so earthy and raw, and it smells like dried fish, and it smells like sweat, and it smells like burnt coal fires, and it smells like home. It smells like Africa. And I remember walking on the plane, and that plane smelled like perfume, and it smelled like, I don't know, Glade. And I still, it's really weird that I can smell the way the plane smelled versus the way home felt. And I, you know, I was, remember as the plane took off, my mom hadn't cried in the, I hadn't seen my mother cry in the entire month of what had happened in Liberia. And as the plane took off, she just started to heave, you know, these racking sobs. And it's a very, you know, it's like, there's so many things in my life I don't remember. That night I remember really sharply.
This is a tough question to ask, but do you feel some guilt about the Liberia that your ancestors built?
Yeah, I feel a lot. There's a lot of ambivalence. I feel pride, and I feel guilt. And it's this, you know, that's taken me a long time to sort of work through. I'm so incredibly proud of them that they got on that ship and that they, you know, they, if it weren't for them, I don't know where I would be right now. And I look at what they built, and I am, you know, I remember when I found Elijah Johnson's journal, the one that he kept when he was on that ship in 1820. And I was at the, I found it through these diary, these papers at the Library of Congress, and I was shaking as I'm reading it, and you can see his handwriting, and he's writing as he's at sea. And there was this one passage that blew me away. He said, "Today, while we were up on deck, John Fisher whipped his wife. I think this is a very dull lamp for me to be carrying with me into a dark continent, but I have not lost faith in my God." And I think he was enormously strong. But at the same time, there is a lot of ambivalence because I wish they could have been, I wish the system that they set up had not been. I wish they had looked at the native Africans as their brothers and sisters and not this, you know, superior class type structure. But at the same time, I also know that that's sort of, you know, we're all human beings. And this is one of the things that sort of, you know, we all can look back at what our ancestors did and not be, you know, sort of how it's made me a lot less black and white about racism, a lot less black and white about, you know, a lot of things that have happened, you know, in the past, because I know that it's sort of a part of all of us and we can just keep trying to improve upon ourselves.
As one reviewer called this book, it's a masterful memoir.
I like that review.
I liked it too. I liked it too. And it was dead on. And incidentally, it was written by a woman who... 2 years before she wrote it, won the Pulitzer Prize for a novel that she wrote.
Yeah.
So it was by a, it wasn't some fluffy review. It was,
no.
It was very serious. One of the things I think that's so masterful about this book is the rhythms of it, the language of it, the richness of the family relationships. One thing I wanted to ask you on a lighter note is there's plenty of times in the book, which I think any of us who have siblings can really identify with.
Molly, coming for you.
And Marlene's here. Now, in this book, Helene talks about Marlene's yucky room, her annoying little sister, all these things. So this book has these wonderful, very personal interfamily relationships, and you can tell from that this is a really close family. Tell us about what's happened to all the relatives now, and you know, where is everybody? Is everybody in the United States? There's some people that made it over here, some people didn't.
We're scattered all over the place. My mom lives in Alexandria, Virginia, very close to me and very close to Marlene. Eunice is in Liberia. She made her first visit here last year, and it was awesome.
She's a Bintu now.
She's a total Bintu now. She thinks she's like Miss Cool. My father died in 1985, but my brother is in Atlanta. I have a sister in New York, and then I have hundreds of cousins. The Cooper family is ginormous. And I, you know, when I was doing my book tour in September and October, I'm like traveling all over the country, and I swear, there were Coopers coming out of like Seattle. I'm like, what are you doing here in Seattle? You know, it's a huge, 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 huge family, and they've been great. I was really nervous about how my family was going to take the book. I wanted for my mom and Marlene and Eunice to be okay with it, and they were great. I was much more certain that the larger Cooper family would be very skittish. Why am I writing this? Why am I dredging all this stuff out? And by and large, you know, they've amazed me. They've been so awesome. They've been so, like, it's so cool that they've been proud of me. I've always felt like I was the one member of the family who's always, like, messing up and all, all of that, because they're all very, you know, they can be pretty, you know, pompous. But so it's, you know, it's the part about actually, you know, making my family proud that I've like sat down and I've chronicled, you know, where we came from and all that has been really cool.
When you returned to Liberia for the first time, it was as if everybody in Liberia who was still there knew exactly what you were doing in life.
That was the weirdest thing. I mean, they were all like, there are these people there who've gone through years of civil war and all this stuff, and they're like, oh my God, you were in Iraq. We heard you were in Iraq. How did you manage? Blah, blah, blah.
I
was like, hello? This child soldier standing there on amphetamines, you know, holding you guys up with an AK-47. You're worried about me in Iraq? Yeah. It was very, it's like this complete, you know.
No phones.
No phones, no electricity.
No running water, no newspaper, no TV.
No.
And they know and they're that Marlene like, Cooper yeah, writes for
yeah,
the New York Times.
Well, yes, yes.
It yeah. says something about you, and it says something about
this
Liberia.
Is the funny, perfect coda to end this. I got moved to the White House beat for the New York Times when Obama got elected. And during his first news conference, he called on me.
Right.
So it was that televised news conference, and I was, you know, I was completely nervous and all that. And I asked my question. He completely blew it off and, like, moved on. And after that, I walked out of there, and my phone is just, like, going crazy. And it was one after another Liberian calling me. They're like, we're so proud. This is such a big day for Liberia. And I was like, that's, yeah.
That is fantastic.
That part is cool.
I like to, there's some wonderful journalists in this room right now, and there's a bunch of colleagues and friends. I'd like to open it up for some questions. But before I do that, I want to welcome our young colleagues here. We have Meherit Morrison, my colleague Steve Morrison's daughter, and her friends from school, and they have a book club. And I think this is the next book you guys are going to read, right? Great.
I hope so.
Let's open it up for some questions. I think Ann Guerin's here. I think Ann wants to ask a question.
You're going to put Ann on the spot?
Yeah.
That is, like, so mean. Because this is a perfect chance for...
Well, actually, I sort of came prepared. I'll ask a question that is sort of through me from my mother-in-law, who recently read your book after I gave it to her for Christmas. She's very impressed to have a signed copy. And she asked me what you had thought when you were in Iraq about the war that you weren't in. And I know you've talked about this a little bit, and you talk about it some in the book, but I wondered if you would be willing to talk a little bit about what that at that time you thought before you wrote the book.
There's a lot about Iraq that it reminded me of Liberia. And you would see we'd be going in this convoy through these Iraqi villages and towns, and people would come to the road and look at us. And there were so many times that happened when I would imagine, you know, people in Liberia coming up to the road, you know, and looking at sort of the soldiers, but knowing also that in Liberia it was so much worse than what was happening in Iraq. I mean, the war in Liberia is like no other. You know, I can't even begin to describe. There, you have rebel soldiers who are dressed up in wedding gowns and blonde wigs because they believe that that's sort of magic, and that's going to protect them from bullets. And you have, you know, amphetamine-fueled soldiers, and you have kids who are kidnapped from their mothers and dragged off to be soldiers in this war, and people are fighting and not knowing what they're fighting for. And it's so, in so many ways, it was so surreal that it almost felt sometimes like the Iraq War was the organized war, and this is how, you know, this is how white people fight wars. And I'm thinking in my mind that, you know, that's not how we fight wars in Liberia. That's not how we fight in Africa. You know, and this disconnect that I just kept thinking, you know, what am I? Have I become so Americanized that I can't deal with, you know, with where I come from? And so there was a lot of that going on when I was in Iraq.
Did it feel bittersweet when you got your U.S. citizenship? Did you feel like you were abandoning your country?
Yeah, I did. But I was also really happy. You know, at the point that I got my citizenship was 1997. I was really in complete disconnect mode. I was, you know, Liberia wasn't happening. I had shut it down. I was going to be American. I was going to have I traveled so much for work at the time, and I had to get a visa to cross the street with my Liberian passport, and people would look at it like, you know, what is this? And I just wanted to be done with it. I wanted an American passport. I wanted to know that, you know, if I was ever anywhere dangerous, and they'd evacuate me with the rest of the American citizens. And like, but it was, you know, but it wasn't until a long time later when I finally went back to Liberia, and I went in to the plane landed, and I'm at Roberts Field, and I'm going through immigration, and I give the man my passport. It's the American passport. And he looks at it, and he looks up at me, and he was like, "Cooper." And I said, "Yeah." And he was like, "You're not no American woman." And I just sort of looked at him and smiled, because it's like, you know, I've been in the United States at that point for 23 years, and he totally pinned me as Liberian.
Wow. One thing I wanted to ask you also is you know, before we even get to that, tell us what happened when you were covering the State Department and you went on a trip with Madeleine Albright with your Liberian passport.
You just want me to speak. You're just trying to get me to speak Liberian English.
I am. I really am. Because when you read this book, it reminds me of my time in New Orleans, where there's dialects in New Orleans that are much like. Tell us what happened with
this that. Was, there are two stories. One, I had been, I was covering commerce or something for the Wall Street Journal, and Ron Brown was going to China, and I was going with him. And I took my Liberian passport to the Commerce Department, and they were going to, so they could get the visas and all of that. And they called me the next day, and they were like, "This is a Liberian passport." I was like, "Yeah, so what?" And they're just sort of like, "We've just never seen one of these before. Is it real?" And I remember coming back from another trip, coming back from Singapore, and I had gotten my American passport at that point. And I went through Hawaii, and this again, I'm going through passport control, and the guy looked at me and said, "You know, welcome home." And I started crying, and I felt very American. And then I remember once without Madeleine Albright, it was during the run-up to the Kosovo War, and she was doing all this, flying all over the place. And we had this saying in Liberia that we used to have whenever we went to movies. And it's called, whenever we saw like big action blockbuster movies that showed stuff that you never believed could actually happen. And in Liberia, we would say, "White man can lie, oh." It means white man can lie. And that's because that phrase was coined back when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And that's because no Liberian believes that Neil Armstrong.
So
Neil Armstrong is like up there walking, and right, all Liberians right. are like, "Eh, white man can lie." So I'm in the doomsday plane with Madeleine Albright, and we were somewhere over Syria or something. I don't even remember where we were going. And this Marine comes up to me, and he taps me on my shoulder in the middle of the night, woke me up, and he's like, "We're refueling. Do you want to come see?" Because I had told him earlier that it's like, how do you refuel midair? And I had asked him to come. So he takes me up, and I'm like, and they're attaching this hose to one plane, it's under the other plane, and it's like, and I'm looking out the window, and I was like, and this is in the middle of my complete American, you know, and I looked at that thing, and I was like, "Eh, white man can lie." Oh. And it's like thinking, well, actually, they actually are doing it. So it's like, maybe Neil Armstrong actually did walk on the moon.
Right.
It's like, whatever.
Well, Marlene's here. Marlene, do you want to ask your sister a question?
It should. If there are any takers, publishers, you know, I'm happy. I'm happy to start discussions now tonight.
Somebody take the microphone away from her. I think you had
a question
right
in the front?
Back there, right over. Yeah.
So I'm going to fumble over this a little bit, but it seemed like when you're describing Sugar Beach and Liberia, everything was bright, and it seemed like there was never a cloudy, rainy day. And that when you came to the States, and when you're writing about Knoxville and you know Greensboro, it seemed like everything was a rainy day, kind of dreary. And your description of Greensboro just seemed really particularly stark.
Could you tell I didn't like it? I didn't like Knoxville.
So when did the United States kind of feel like it was home? When did it feel like, wow, it's sunny here, it's kind of, this is my place?
That's actually a really good question. It started in Greensboro. We went to Knoxville for the first year, and yeah, it was cloudy in Knoxville. Never, just rain. No sun in Knoxville, as far as I was concerned. I was miserable. I used to hide in the bathroom during lunchtime because I didn't have any friends to sit and eat with in the cafeteria at school. I know, but that's something that finally, I connected with you. Okay.
Will you guys take Helene to school for lunch
one
day?
I know. I just need to redo.
I think
but I would sit in the toilet stall, and I would like close the door, and I would just sit there, and it was a way to get through like lunch. And then we moved to Greensboro the next year, and we're living with my dad then, and my mom had gone back home. And that was really hard for both me and Marlene, because for the first time now, we had, you know, our mom was not there. And that was really difficult. But I slowly, by then I'm in the 11th grade, and I started to make friends. This one boy in my chemistry class, I still remember it so clear to me when I walked into chemistry class on the first day of school, and he said to me, "You're following me," because he had been in my algebra class before that, and it was like the first really friendly thing somebody had said. And I just felt like, you know, it's so important to you at that age to just not be weird. And in Knoxville, I was the weird African girl. And all I wanted in Greensboro was to just be like everybody else. And to have a friend, and to have like, and that was like a big deal. And the sun sort of started to come out for me in Greensboro. By the time I graduated from high school, I was pretty, and this is part of the, you know, sort of the weird psychologic journey or whatever, because I found like, and this is part of why I ended up distancing myself so much more from Liberia, was that I realized that the more American I acted, the less weird I seemed with everybody else, and the easier it seemed for me to have friends. So in my mind, there was this, you know, if you can just become more American and be more like the other kids, you know, you can have friends and you'll be, you know. And that was part of the whole, you know, distancing myself from Liberia as I became more American. And it's like, you don't really become, you're not really, you know, complete unless you can be all of who you are. Now, that's, I'm totally botching that up, but yes.
Was it hard for you to, like, make the transition between, like, the Liberian culture and then coming to America where it's, like, totally different, basically?
Yes and no. In Liberia, we love Americans. And I went to the American school in Liberia, so I used to practice. Before I went to school in the morning, I would stand in the mirror and I would practice American accent. I'd say, "Hi there. How are you? What's happening, blood?" And so I thought I could speak with an American accent by the time I got to...
What did you all call that, speaking?
Kolo, talking Kolo. Yeah. So when I got to Knoxville, it was, I could fake it. I just didn't really want to fake it as much at first. And then I sort of realized that I needed to fake it in order to be more accepted by everybody else. The cultural thing was hard, though. There were parts that were easy because I could fake the accent. I could do the accent. And there were parts that were really hard. And I really, you know, but part of it was just mostly like I just really missed my family and I missed home, you know, and I missed the food and I missed the smells, you know. But the United States can be very seductive. You know, it doesn't take, that's why people keep coming here. It doesn't take that long to sort of learned that it, in a lot of ways, things in America are just easier. You know, there, it's just so much easier than living in Liberia.
When you ended up going to college, you went to Chapel Hill, North University of North Carolina, mm-hmm. and you were, by then, you were pretty much Americanized.
Yeah. Yeah, by
the time I got basketball, and
by the time threw myself into Carolina Tar Heels, and yeah, I was very, very Americanized by then.
Now I have a question. You mentioned that in Liberia you had you always had access to American cultural things, and your mom would bring videos of Mary Tyler Moore. Is that why you wanted to become a reporter?
No, Mary Tyler Moore. No, I decided I wanted. It was Britt Hume. Remember?
Oh yes.
No, when we first moved to the U.S., I used to watch the ABC World News Tonight, and I would see Britt Hume in front of the State Department with all the flags behind him. I was like, ooh, I want to be like him. And then I read All the President's Men in 11th grade, and I was hooked after that. I really, you know, and journalism was, you know, from that moment on, it was I never wanted to do anything else but that.
That's great. Questions?
Yes.
You mentioned food earlier. What was it like for you, like, when you're, like, eating the American food? Because I know, like, it's really strange seeming.
I thought it was bland because I was so used to spicy Liberian food. So my mom, I remember when we first moved here in Knoxville, she would make American-style soup out of the can with Campbell's and that kind of stuff. And I thought, you know, I'm used to my Liberian pepper soup. But, you know, after a while you start to, but Liberian food is so good. It's so flavorful and it's got a lot of spice in it and always has a kick. In Liberia, we don't believe that food is really good unless it hurts while you eat it. It hurts as in, you know, you should be crying, your nose should be running and all that means it's good. It's the heart that makes it good.
Let's go to Elise.
I think what's interesting is all this talk about how Helene embraced the American culture, because those of us that are friends with her see her as really still Liberian and a lot of talking Liberian and Liberian food and things like that. So I'm wondering at what point you kind of felt that it was okay to, was it after you traveled and saw Eunice and wrote the book that you were able to embrace your kind of Liberianness again and become a whole person? Because I think that your Liberian heritage is still very strong to you and your family here.
Yeah. I never really left it, and I think I felt it was okay after when I was in once I got away from the whole teenage years and college where you're trying to fit in. Once I got away from that, I was never American when I was home. You know, even in during my teenage years, and even when I was going through, you know, high school and college and faking my accent and all of that. When I went home, I was talking to my dad and my sister, and we're Liberian. And so I think it's all part of the growing up and becoming an adult that you realize you're just going to be who you are, and it's totally fine to be who you are. But I never really, I just learned how to, I guess what I did is I stopped separating the two. And it was much more that, and letting people, realizing that I wasn't being fair to my American friends, pretending that I was one thing when I'm actually not, and letting them into the Liberian part of my life and vice versa. You know, sometimes I used to think that I had to, you know, I had to have my Liberian friends and I had to have my American friends. I could never, like, mix the two. And it was kind of, it took a long time to just realize that this is all, you know, it's fine to just throw people together.
We have a question right up here in the front next to Elise.
Hi. We talked briefly before the session. First of all, I want to say thank you for doing the book and for sharing so honestly. And as you were talking, my mind is flashing because you really represent, you know, three traditions. Firstly, you're African-American because that was your heritage here. Then you're Liberian. That's where you grew up. But then you're African-American again. So you really span these cultures in a very unique way. Now, I'm involved, as I mentioned to you, with the Maryland State Liberian sister state relationship. And one of the things we're trying to do is to, again, make folks aware of the relationship, these long historical relationships between the United States, and in this case, the state of Maryland, and Liberia. The county in Liberia called Maryland was founded, as you know, by freed African Americans from the state of Maryland. So my question is, given your history and what you've seen, I'd be interested in your ideas about how to bridge the gap between African Americans and Africans in this country that exists right now.
I would really like to see African Americans just pay more attention to Africa in general. You go to Liberia and people there know about here. It's the other way around that people here don't know about there. You know, I grew up completely immersed in American culture and Michael Jackson albums and all of that sort of thing. If you go to Liberia now, you're going to see, you know, you go all over the world. You know, American culture is one of those things that is very alive, is our biggest export. And in Liberia, they get that. You know, they're so excited about Barack Obama, and they're so, you know, you see so much of that there. I found that it doesn't flow the other way. So many of my black friends didn't know when I met them here, you know, my African American friends could, you know, had no idea what Liberia was or what, you know, and could not have, you know, it's not, they're just not plugged in. So I would like to see, you know, be my wish to see African Americans here engage more, because it's going to have to come from here. You know, these are third world countries. There's just the engagement has to start over here, and it has to start with sort of the interest in these, particularly in West Africa, but the interest. And I think Obama and his story is going to go a long way, you know, towards that.
I want to follow up on that for a minute before we take a few more from the audience. Liberia has really come a long way, and I'm told, you know, Bob Johnson's building a hotel in Liberia. But I'm also told by some of the people who are building that hotel with Bob Johnson that you can't imagine what it's like there when you live in the United mm-hmm. States and you go back, and they still have a long way to go. Can you talk about the leadership of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and what's happening there now?
The election of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, first woman president elected in an African country, is huge. I can't even begin to just say just how big a deal that is, just because in all over the continent, women drive that. Women literally carry Africa on their back. These women are the strongest women that you will ever meet. They've been through so much. They've been, you know, raped, and they've been, you know, harassed, and they've been, you know, forced into pregnancy, raped and left pregnant in the forest, and they have their babies, and they put those babies on their back, and they keep going. Their kids are kidnapped from them and taken off to be child soldiers, and they keep going. They take those kids back, and they fight, and they're the market women who are sitting out on the side of the road, and they're selling oranges, and they're the women who, like, when all the men are going out there and they're fighting and they're doing this and they're doing that, these women are functional, and they're high-spirited, and they're out there, and they're still having their kids, and they're still raising their families, and they're for them to, after all of these years of being targeted, of being abused, of being, to turn around and to see a woman elected president is so huge, to actually get something back like this. It was women that elected Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and it's such a huge thing. And for it to happen in my country, you know, I think it's such a shining example all over Africa, which is still so paternalistic, and it's so male-dominated. So I think just for that, even if she was the worst president ever, and she's not, by far, because that's not, you know, it's so huge. But she has a huge hole to dig out of. This country is coming out of 23 years of completely pointless wars. It's got such a hole to dig out of. It's still no electricity. There's still no running water. It's like the reconstruction effort in Liberia is going to take years and years. And so anybody who starts to measure it in months or, is not. So I think I'm glad to see it in her hands, because I think she's going to smoke any of the people, her predecessors, so that's not that hard to do. But I also hope people are realistic about just how quickly this can come back. It's starting to come back, but it's going to be hard.
It's going to be an amazing experience for you when one day you land in Liberia with the White House press corps and go into Liberia and the President of the United States meets with the President of Liberia. Last time this happened, you were 7.
I was 12. I was 12. On the side of the road with Jimmy Carter, and we wanted to see Amy.
Yeah. And she drove by really fast.
I never even saw her, but we pretended we did.
But you and Eunice thought,
we pretended we were very excited.
And where was Marlene when that was happening?
Who knows?
We have time for a couple more. I know that a lot of you want to say hello to Helene in person, so we'll take a couple more. We have one in the back there. Monica?
You spoke about when you were younger having this kind of embarrassment about, wanting to fit in and having being embarrassed about being from Liberia when you were a kid. But then when you talked about the press conference, which I saw you ask your question, you talked about the pride. It seems like you have a lot of pride about being from Liberia, and obviously Liberians have a lot of are proud to see you so successful. But my question is it hard for you that you speak now with such an American accent? And when I look at you, I had no idea that you were Liberian until I heard about this book. So do you feel, how do you feel about when the ordinary American looks at you, that they don't know that this rich history that you have? And do you feel like you've lost something by, not having an accent? So I'm just curious your thoughts.
I think I do have an accent. My accent is still there when I'm speaking with my family and when I'm speaking with Liberians. It would seem forced if I tried to do it on a daily basis with Americans. Because I read somewhere that if you move before the age of 15, you lose your accent, and if you move after, you don't. My mom sounds completely Liberian. I have older cousins who moved here after 15, and they sound completely Liberian, whereas Marlene and I sound American. My brother, who was 18 when he moved here, he can kind of do the American, but he has a slight accent when you talk to him. Now, if I were talking to my family people, I would be talking with Liberian accent, and not that hard for me to do. And I still somehow had a dream with my Liberian accent while dreaming. But it's completely, it would be forced for me to do it if I'm in a press conference, because I, from the time I was, I should try that though, next time. Yeah. No, that I don't feel. A lot of people think, I don't look at myself in any way as a role model for anybody. I'm just, I wouldn't even begin to want to be. So, no.
Helene is the person who made us bring the alcohol up here.
You were the one who was, serving Pabst Blue Ribbon beer here. So, no, I've never, and that's partly, it sounds a little bit like I'm, I don't think a lot of reporters look at themselves as, standing as examples for anything. We're much more, we want to chronicle life, and we want to write about life the way it is. And this is basically the way I am. And I've never felt, that's probably why I'm not in politics, and you'll never see me in politics, but I've never felt like I have a responsibility to serve as a role model or to carry my country. What I want to do is I want to be able to tell the story of my country, and I want to be able to tell the story of, of other people and people, who are, I want to be able to tell this story, but I don't feel like I'm an example for anybody.
Great. Let's take one more. Over here.
I'm John Casebolt, here at CSIS. I've got a brother-in-law from Tennessee, and I'm surprised you stayed in America. Yeah, he's from Eastern Tennessee, real close to Knoxville.
I'm not even touching that one.
But I lost my mother when I was 11, and my half brother and I were separated, so I can understand your, you know, relationship with Eunice. After 25 years, I've got one friend from high school that he and I are still really close and keep in touch with. And I was wondering if you were able to find a friend like that when you came to America.
I do. I found I have one of my best friends is one who in Greensboro, North Carolina, we were in the same drama class together, Allison Young. And we went to Chapel Hill together, University of North Carolina, and she is still to this day probably my best friend.
That's a great way to end. We want to thank Helene.
Can we get one more from just because Jenna's Liberian?
Yeah.
Can you do it in a Liberian accent? Okay. Oh, I'll answer you in a Liberian accent too.
I'm not going to hear my question.
That's all right.
But the thing I want to ask you is, I read about your first heartbreak.
Amen. I feel about you. Got me doing about?
You are the team. I want to know.
What you want to know?
As a
your boss still fun. All right. She doesn't get a question. We can go now.
I mean, I'm really struggling with my parents' expectations of what they have of me as a Liberian young woman, their expectations, and like just the reality of growing up here, what my parents expect, and then growing up here, maybe what I'm looking for. I'm really trying to find that common ground. Just want to know if you're able to work.
I am so the last person anybody should come to for dating advice. Because I have the worst record ever. So I think you should just be who you are, you know? And if you end up with an American guy, so what? Your parents will deal with it. You can come home with a Nigerian, they'll deal with it. And that's saying something. I think we have to end now.
All right, okay. Ladies and gentlemen, Helene Cooper.